So it is May 26, 2006, and I'm David Brooks. I'm the interviewer for the University of Montana's Oral History Project, and this morning I'm talking with Dr. Robert Curry. And Dr. Curry, I was hoping you could start with a brief personal and educational background and what brought you to the University of Montana.
Certainly. Born and raised in Bloomington, Indiana, educated Indiana University, medical degree from Indiana University, moved to Anchor Hospital in St. Paul, Minnesota for my internship. At that point, wanted to go west, and my wife and I continued with our medical practice here in Missoula in 1959. We were with the Western Montana Clinic for 1 year. During that time, I worked at the University of Montana Student Health Service on a weekly basis, spending 2 or 3 hours taking care of students. After 6 years of interim visits to the university, I was hired as the director. I actually applied to be a full-time director for the University of Montana Student Health Service. That was in 1965. And from that point until approximately 2002, I've been there in some capacity. Actually, I retired in 95, but continued to work part-time for 7 or 8 years.
Through 2002. So you were in private practice in Missoula for a relatively short time. What made you want to move out of private practice and to the university?
Very good question. I was 6 years in private practice and moved in with two other general practitioners, they were called at that time, family practice now. Delivered babies, had all the typical family practice, pediatrics, minor surgery, everything. Very busy, too busy. Decided that since I was on a committee from the Western Montana Medical Society to find a full-time physician for the university, after interviewing doctors for 2 years and finding no one really interested, I applied for the job. And I was duly awarded that position and have enjoyed it ever since. And I knew that I would enjoy taking care of young people and especially the athletes, because I had an interest in sports medicine. Being an athlete myself, I really wanted to get involved with young people and take care of their soft tissue injuries, et cetera, et cetera.
And what was the sports medicine program as well as the health center like when you first came here? And you know, reiterate a little bit of the history of it as you know it.
Well, the sports medicine program was Naze Reinhardt. I don't know whether you know the name. He was a fantastic black athlete at the University of Montana in the late 30s, coming from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Very interesting story, but I won't go into that. But Naze Reinhardt was a self-trained trainer, an athletic trainer. And he acquired his education by on-the-job training as well as going to every conference he could find and doing courses. And eventually, during the 40s, 50s, actually began to put together an athletic training curriculum. And therefore, he was pretty much the sports medicine person. Physicians who helped him were local physicians, whoever happened to be willing to give some service to him and to the athletes. And of course, when I came on board in 65, I took that position over and was the team physician for all sports for essentially the remainder of the time that I was here. Naturally, I had help from my staff as I hired other physicians on during the 60s and 70s and 80s. So it's been a gradual increase in activity of sports medicine. I taught a sports medicine course from the 70s on until it was taken over by one of my predecessors and enjoyed that very much. What I was primarily doing was teaching the coaches who were getting advanced degrees, some nursing students who began to have classes here, and physical therapy students were in my class, and it was a good class. We took students right to the operating rooms, let them see surgery on knees, ankles, elbows, hands, whatever. And it was a very enlightening experience for them to actually witness the surgical procedures that we talk about in class.
And there were operating rooms on campus?
No. These were the local hospitals.
Okay.
St. Patrick Hospital, Community Hospital.
So you were working in conjunction with local hospitals. They allowed the staff from the university as well as students to attend those sort of things.
They used to. Mm-hmm. That, unfortunately, because of liability concerns, no longer exists.
When did it go out of existence?
Approximately, I expect 1990, mm-hmm. something. Maybe mm-hmm. earlier than that, 85. As you know, the legality problems of medicine and all the privacy things now absolutely eliminate that potential. Mm-hmm. But it was a great thing at the time. Students really appreciated it. I would take 1, 2, 3 students with me. We would actually gown and mask, cap, and go into the operating room to view what was going on. And that part is no longer available mm-hmm. to our students. But at the time, it was well received, and I think students learned a lot from it.
And at the time, what were the medical facilities on campus? I mean, now you go to the health center, the Curry Health Center, and there's a pharmacy, there's a dental office. You have full outpatient care anyway. You know, you can go in and have a physical or be looked at if you're sick and that sort of thing. Certainly no surgery, but there's quite a facility there.
Yes.
So how does that compare?
Well, and there was a building built in 1955, land grant, and that facility actually housed a pharmacy. There was a state mental health facility in the basement of that building, which was not part of the university as such. It was a state-operated mental health clinic. Upstairs, the Student Health Service existed with inpatient facilities for limited care. Obviously, we didn't do any ICU or any type of surgical care. However, we could take care of our post-op cases, appendectomies, etc., orthopedic procedures that were completed and needed a day or two more of rest, we could admit them into our facility. And we had 24-hour nursing, and we had an emergency room where we could do minor things such as suture up injuries, lacerations, etc., take care of sprained ankles and banged up knees, shoulders, whatever. Therefore, we felt that as a limited facility, we could take care of most of the things, probably 99% or 98% of student problems that acutely occurred day or night. And if we couldn't, we knew exactly what to do with them, where to send them, and pave the way. So we were their number one medical resource, we felt, and our educational possibilities were just enormous. This is a group of people who have never been on their own. They leave mom and dad, and they come to the university, and they're wide-eyed and bushy-tailed, but they don't know a thing about how to take care of their medical mm-hmm. problems. So we tried to fill that gap, and there's many ways that we did that.
Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about what their medical concerns or needs were at the time, both, I suppose, acute things you saw, as well as what were the daily concerns that students had and would come to the medical center for.
Well, everything you could possibly conceive. The important issue was that students realized that we were right on campus, we were readily available, they could come in, as we say, 24 hours, 7 days a week. Most of the problems were relatively minor, but we would see anywhere from 150 to 250 students a day. That's average. As soon as I was hired on as full-time director, I immediately hired another full-time person. And within a couple of years, we had 4 full-time physicians. Had to have, because of the number of students that we saw. We also oriented the freshmen to the fact that they could come to the Student Health Service for any medical or dental need. And the dental service came into existence in the late 70s. which we were one of the first facilities in the United States to offer dental care. And we did that because the students required emergency dental care fairly frequently. And we were having difficulty placing them in the local dentist's offices. So we had help from some of our local dentists to provide a place. So we started with operatives and so forth for the dental service and hired a full-time dentist within a couple of years, two full-time dentists. And so our dental services were very well received and very well used.
Mm-hmm. So I was reading the Curry Health Center's mission statement this morning, and just to start out the beginning of it, it says, Curry Health Center provides affordable, accessible, high-quality, student-centered health services. And, you know, I've interviewed a few other people who, say, a professor in sociology who at the time, early 60s through the early 70s, talks about having to go to the dean of his school to get funding just for a calculator and adding machine. And here you are building a dental clinic, having 24-hour care. Where were the funding for that all coming from? And I guess in answering that, talk a little bit more about your staff size and composition.
Sure. Well, that's the beauty of this system. We operated on a budget that was entirely generated from student funds. The student paid the fee. This did not come out of the university general fund. This was a specific health fee. And on their registration form and their fee form, there was a specific item, health fee. Every student paid, when I came here, $10 a quarter. Now that's fairly inexpensive health care. We also had an agreement with Blue Cross of Montana, and that fee was even less, something like $3 a quarter. And that fee took care of things that we couldn't handle, like an appendectomy, the surgery was handled downtown, etc. Well, as you know, in the late 50s and 60s, a house call was even done back then, $10. An office call, $3. Now, you can't conceive of that because your age is, you're a little young. But that's when I started in private practice in Missoula. Those were the kinds of fees. And half the time, people I saw on house calls couldn't afford it. So I would write them off. Didn't worry about it. So things have changed a great deal. We obviously had needs, like the dental clinic, building more facilities. We would go to the student. We would work through ASUM and the students in general and survey and ask them, would they be willing to pay $2 more? So the fee would go to $12 a quarter. Then in a couple of years, we'd need something more. It would go to $15 a quarter. And when I left in 95, I think our fee was up to approximately $35 or $40 a semester when we changed the semester. This is still very, very inexpensive. It's a whole lot more now. I don't even want to, in fact, I don't know what the student health fee is right now. But it's considerably more than that because of inflation, et cetera. But at any rate, we had a very supportive student body. We were never turned down on any request. They always came through for us, and in about a 95% total. I mean, they just said, do it, because we appreciate what you're doing. You ask about the staff. We had 24-hour nursing care, excellent nursing staff, well-trained, dedicated people, loved students. Physician staff, as I mentioned, went from one, myself, in 65 to two in 66 to three in 68, four in 70 or something like that. So we rapidly increased our staff. I hired on excellent people. I would not hire on people who were really ready to retire and didn't want to work. I hired on people who really wanted to get into student health, and I made sure of that. Therefore, my administrative activities were very minimal. I still saw as many patients as my team colleagues, my physicians, would see. And I felt that by doing that, I would know exactly what the students' feelings were, I know what their needs were, I'm in the mix. And later, as committees became more important to the university, I was involved with too many committees. Many times I would send a surrogate. I didn't feel that my time was well spent sitting in a room for 2 hours discussing some other problem. I felt I could do a lot more if I was there to take care of students. So that kind of gives you an idea of the type of leadership that I prefer. I like to see somebody who can lead by example and go out and do the work. If I'm an educator, I want to educate. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be in a committee meeting.
And how much education continued in the health center? You mentioned when you first got here being able to take students to an operating room.
Sure.
Even when that went by the wayside, which you said wasn't until possibly the 90s, how much educating did you do in the health center?
It was one of our primary focuses was to see youngsters who had never been on their own, allow them to see what good medical care was all about. And many times we would try to tell them, look, when you get out of here, make sure you find a good family practitioner or a care person who has a conscience, who really cares for you and who is willing to listen. Willing to listen to you, because that's what makes a good physician, is someone who is a caring person, who has a conscience, who really wants to do the right thing and will listen to your complaints. And as you well know, one of the biggest complaints that I hear about physicians is they don't take the time to listen. So if they don't listen, they don't get the full story, and many times that leads them down the wrong trail.
Mm-hmm. So how about some of the educational campaigns you possibly did through the health center?
Oh,
you know, now you
sure,
see in the
sure.
college center anti-drinking and driving
sure,
or binge drinking campaigns, safe sex campaigns, things of that nature. Talk a little bit about the different things that you did to make the student body aware of general health issues.
We were into all of that. I had different staff members doing cardiovascular kinds of things. I started a fitness activity with Brian Sharkey and John Dayries in the HPE department, and we started jogging. We had times that we would jog around the old Darn Blazer Field, which was where this building is right now. And that got good response. We had people who began to jog. And this was back in the 60s, of course. The other kinds of things, as you mentioned, the sexuality issues. I was constantly going to dorms and fraternities and sororities talking about sexuality problems. Now, AIDS was not, we weren't aware of AIDS back then. AIDS came into view about 85. So there were 20 years that I talked about venereal diseases and you might call it safe sex. We talked about the causes and the ways to prevent and a little bit about morals, actually. And it was well received, had good audiences, and it was wide open. We let the students, I was primarily the one who was doing all this because I felt it was very, very important. And we talked about drugs. And we talked about anything they really wanted to talk about. But sex is always interesting, and people will come to hear about sex no matter what. It's the most important item, I guess, that on young people's minds.
Mm-hmm.
Than getting an education, I hope.
Right. So do you suspect, and you know, I'm just hypothesizing here, that you came in the middle of the 60s, which of course the lay interpretation of that is free mm-hmm. love and drugs
right.
and counterculture. Was that something that you think was probably new, those interests, those willingness to talk about it, the staff from the medical center going out and approaching those issues? Was that new to the 60s and early 70s?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. This is when birth control came in. The birth control pill came mm-hmm. in the 60s. And this was a hot issue every place, but not here. We did not feel that this is an area that we should be doing any kind of judging as far as who should be on birth control, who should not be on birth control. What we needed to do was treat each case individually and educate as we go. And we found that this was also the time that abortion was illegal. This was before Roe Wade. And there were illegal abortionists in the state of Montana. I can even tell you the communities, but I won't. Therefore, students were, if they became pregnant, they would go to these illegal places with their cash in hand and an appointment and have an illegal abortion, and not a very sterile procedure. And many times we would have very sick kids coming back to campus, and we would have to hospitalize with sepsis, with really serious, serious infection from poorly done medical procedures. So we tried to use common sense. We tried to preach the fact that, you know, if you were going to be sexually active, you should be safe and you should use birth control. And obviously a venereal disease is brought into that, but back at that time, AIDS wasn't a problem. We could treat gonorrhea and syphilis, and we didn't have very much of it, but it was out there. And students were infected on occasion, and we would take care of that. But birth control was not an issue for us as it was other health services. Our sister institutions sometimes would not deal with the problem. They would say, well, you'll have to go downtown. Well, we felt that this is our job. This is the job of the student health service, to get on board with students and discuss the problem. And if we felt individually that they needed birth control, we would write the prescription and follow them. Obviously, with a good pelvic examination, a pap smear, breast exam, the whole nine yards. And that, to me, made good sense, because we could follow them, we could educate as they went along. They're maturing. They're finding their way. And it made good sense. We had absolutely no policy. Everybody said, what is your policy in regards to birth control? I said, excuse me, that's an individual issue. We have no policy regarding birth control. Therefore, we had no problem. None whatever. We did not have any issues on our campus in regards to birth control.
So before, you said, you know, you had something like 95% support when you went for extra funds for the health center, or just the health center in general was widely supported. But I suspect if there was any opposition, it possibly surrounded these issues.
Well,
is that true?
You know, I couldn't tell you exactly why, because there were so few opposed to what we were doing, that the issues were kind of non-existent. I mean, some people just vote no because they didn't want to spend the extra couple of bucks and didn't have a particular reason. They just said, ah, I don't use the health service. You know, there are those out there that would do that. And I had no problem with that at all. But because the great majority use the health service, we would do research on our records and find that approximately 75% of the students would use the health service at least once a year. And by the time they get out of school, almost 100% have used the health service. I don't know how that percentage would work out today, but we felt we were visible and that we were doing something, and as you say, we were trying to educate. We did this also with the faculty. We wanted our faculty to know that we were there to help them with problem students. So I met with the department heads of every school in the university. I would ask them if I could come to their faculty meetings so that I could talk to not only the deans of the faculty, but also the faculty themselves. And there's quite a few schools, and there's quite a few deans, as you know. And we came to them and expressed the fact that if you have problem students, if there's somebody depressed, somebody not attending class, and you have a suspicion that there's something going on with these people, please call us or bring the student over. Give us a call. Let me know what's going on, and we'll make sure that the student gets some attention. And the faculty really appreciated this, and many would do just exactly that. When they would have a problem student, a problem situation, they would actually call themselves, the faculty themselves would call the health service and say, hey, I've got a problem here. Could we come over and see Dr. Curry or somebody? Mm-hmm. And, of course, I had my staff clued into this, and they would say, yes, right away, you can be seen. And there was always a situation where we had physicians on call so that that could happen and did happen on many occasions.
Mm-hmm. So that reminds me of when you said you first got here, there was a state mental health facility in the basement or in the downstairs. How much did you deal with mental health, and in what ways? What was your capacity to do so?
Well, as time passed, that mental health unit was transferred out to Fort Missoula, still under state, not under the university. So we decided, since we didn't have that facility close at hand for a referral, that we actually hired mental health people to come into our facility and set them up with offices. So we had a psychiatrist, psychologist, psychiatric nurse. And so we had a little psychiatric unit ourselves. And yes, indeed, it was a big part of the student health service, because as you know, mental health problems exist probably more today than they did back then, but they are always there. And it's just a matter of identifying them and getting them to seek help. Because it's a pride thing. You don't want to go to see a mental health worker if you don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's becoming more and more accepted, and people don't even think much about it now. Depression is so common, and other mental health problems are now accepted. Don't worry about it. We can treat, and you can get better.
So I'm going to ask you a question that's probably a little broader than just the university, but that's something that you hear a lot of, is that depression is very common now, or learning, you know, attention deficit disorder is one of the more recent phenomenons really in mental health, especially when in young people and in education is concerned. Are these things that were just missed before, or have these developed and blossomed? Which is probably not the right verb, but which way is it?
You know, I wish I could answer that intelligently, but I can't, because to be perfectly honest, when I was involved with the 60s, 70s, we did not have attention disorder problems, period. I mean, we weren't aware of such. We were certainly aware of depression, we were aware of schizophrenia, we were aware of lots of disorders, bipolars, et cetera, et cetera. But as far as attention deficit, all we would know probably was that, hey, this student doesn't take tests well, or this student isn't seems to be a bright student but not learning. What's going on here? We did not recognize those problems. I don't know how frequent they existed. I don't think very frequently. I really don't think the problem was huge, but it was there. No doubt about the fact that it was there. As time progresses, I don't know what happens, but things change. Depression may or may not be more prevalent. I suspect that it is. There are a lot more problems in the world. There are obviously more ADHD, all that attention deficit business, because people are looking for it and it's being found. And the problem is, sometimes you overreact, sometimes you overtreat. And there's you read lots of stuff in the newspapers, what's going on today, the medication and the treatments may be worse than the disease.
Mm-hmm.
So things change, that pendulum mm-hmm. swings.
So speaking of that sort of change, let's talk about the arc of change and a few things. And the first is, you know, can you make an assessment of either mental or physical health and whether students on this campus that you saw, whether those things improved, declined? You know, and I don't know what factors to even measure. You talked about cardiovascular fitness, or weight is certainly something that's on everybody's radar these days.
Sure.
So a few of those, you know, major characteristics that you think of when you think of general health.
Could
you track an increase or a decline in our health?
Well, here's my answer. We're obviously declining. were declining morally, physically, in all those areas that I was so interested in stopping. I have this to say, and I hope it's accurate. When students left this university, they knew about fitness, they knew about weight, they knew about blood pressure and cardiovascular things. That was on our agenda all the time. And we constantly worked against smoking. I mean, we had programs, we had all kinds of things. And therefore, I think, I hope, that we had an influence on those people that we saw during that period of time. Obviously, it hasn't helped nationally or internationally too, possibly, but this would be the hope, that we would reinstitute our physical education programs, reinstitute exercise and activity, and limit TV time and limit some of these things. And the only one that could do that are the parents. Mm-hmm. So we've got to keep after it and educate parents.
Mm-hmm. How about the change in essentially pharmaceutical care in university students? You know, that my wife and I went away to Japan for 2 years, and the thing we noticed when we came back is turning on the television and suddenly you see drug advertisements. And that seemed to happen within the 2 years we were gone, or we picked up on it. How did that come about on campus? At what rate? And, you know, you had a pharmacy there from the beginning.
Sure, sure.
But changes in prescription drugs, in your ability or willingness to prescribe, what was being prescribed?
Mm-hmm. Well, we, you know, back in those times, 60s, 70s, 80s, the students appreciated the prescriptions we gave them because they had a specific purpose. And generally, a dosage regimen, a certain time span, that was it. There were no advertisements because pharmacies, it was unethical to advertise. There were no physician advertisements, you know, and everything has changed in the last 15 or 20 years in regards to advertising, drugs, physicians, services of that type. Because it was kind of an ethical issue. Now, it doesn't seem to be an issue. It's just, that's what they do. Mm-hmm. And it's not real pleasant for me to see that, because I was born and raised in an era where that did not happen. Mm-hmm. But as far as the health service, we have to take it in stride. We have to do as we know to do and try to do the best we can ethically. And we take care of all our records confidentially. We take care of all the information, the signature. You have to have this to be able to track anything. HIPAA, you know, everything is different now, much more closely guarded, probably overkill. Again, we overreact and the pendulum goes too far one way. But the Student Health Service stays abreast of all of these things. We're right on top of things. Nationally, when we go to student health conferences that include all universities across the nation, we're on top. We've never been anything but right on top of where we need to be. And that's very important.
So you clearly kept abreast while you were the director of other university health centers.
Yes. Oh,
and when you say you are on top, just give me some comparisons. How does the university's health center, or how has it fared compared to other university health centers?
Well, this is totally a selfish view, but we've fared very well. As I say, we were one of the first services that had a dental unit. We are one of the very few who continue to offer inpatient services for students who are ill and need a couple of days of R&R in our facility. Most other student health services have closed up all of their inpatient facilities. They just run a clinic from 8 to 5, and that's it. They don't offer emergency services. They don't offer weekend care. It's really changed a lot. We have not. We have maintained a feeling that we need to be the student's primary medical facility and take care of their needs from A to Z if we possibly can. And if we can't, we know where to get that care. So I think that sets us apart. And as far as I'm concerned, we're on top of the field. We have a good physician to student ratio. You know, we have one physician for approximately every 3,000 students, which that's a lot of students to be taken care of for one physician. That's just a broad view. General practice, one per 1,000 patients is average. One physician per 1,000.
So with the growth in the university and those ratios, yes. You know, my wife is a nurse and has been for a while, and the one thing she notices has changed even in her time in medical field is actual time with patients as opposed to time in front of paperwork. And earlier you mentioned, and I think proudly so, that you didn't do much administration. And certainly there's been some administrative growth in the health center here. How have doctor to patient or nurse to patient times changed with those sorts of loads? And is that something that you think the university does a better job at keeping in balance than, say, medical facilities in the community or in the nation as a whole?
Well, I think we're very aware of the fact that you need to listen to what the patient's telling you. The trend toward students being older, you know, the average age when I started, the student was average age probably 20, 21, 22. Now it's probably closer to 30. And we're talking average age. We're talking freshmen and grad students and the whole mix. So the problems obviously change a bit as you involve people of middle age, and their problems are different than teenagers. So you have to change your method of seeing these people and give them a little bit more time because they have more complicated problems than issues. A simple upper respiratory infection generally is taken care of by a nurse practitioner. Doesn't need to see a physician, and that's perfectly logical. When you get into more involved medical problems, then a physician needs to be involved, and it may take longer, and it may need and require more time. Plus, our patients are more sophisticated. They're watching those TV ads about the medications and the doctors, and so they're inquiring more and more, and they're requiring time.
But no house calls anymore.
No, that's way, way beyond.
Right.
Emergency rooms came in at that point.
So we've been talking about what I'd call sort of chronic or habitual issues in healthcare: smoking, obesity, just cardiovascular health, things of that nature. How about acute things you saw in your time here? Were there any special needs that were timely by way of, you know, the Vietnam War? The Gulf War, even, first Gulf War, you were here at the tail end of that.
Yes.
Any sort of epidemics? Those, you know, we're in the age of terrorism alert. We're aware of places like a university campus being very vulnerable because of the number of people in shared space.
Well, as you well know, President Bob Panzer was the UN president during that Vietnam period of time, and we had a fair number of so-called riotous conditions, but he handled it extremely well. We were minimally involved, but as students would become anxious or acutely aware of that type of thing, we would see them acutely and handle them, I think, pretty appropriately. Because acute things can be handled acutely and calm down and mature, you get along. As far as it really acute things that made a difference with our outfit, influenza, infectious mono, those were the kinds of things that would become epidemic. And we can remember having absolutely a full health service full of inpatients, 30, 40. We could take care of that many, and it wasn't a matter of a long-term care, but a day or two or three to get their fever down, to get them feeling better where they could continue their own care back in the dorm or wherever they were staying. So we had some real major epidemics that we handled, I think, very appropriately and got by very well, had very few bad results. from that. Mono, when I first started practicing, it was a disease where you could only do bed rest. Well, within a few years, medication was available that would turn it around so that you didn't need to send students home to recuperate because they couldn't get to class because they were so tired and they were just not able to function. With new medication, a day or two of bed rest and they were ready to go. And it made all the difference in the world. So we saw fewer and fewer inpatient days because if they come in the right times, we can pretty much avoid the inpatient need. So I think acutely, we just, wherever the ball bounced, that's where we would go and try to stem the tide and make sure that, you know, flu shots now and everything, that's mm-hmm. that's big time.
Mm-hmm. Were there any particular acute health issues on campus that were perhaps not so much beyond campus in the community in general? I mean, every year you have cycles of flu and perhaps even mono. Any particular outbreaks on campus that you remember vividly?
No. Perfectly honestly, what I mentioned to you with the flu and that type of thing. Now, we occasionally have some chicken pox. We occasionally have measles back before the immunizations, etc. But nothing major. Nothing that was, you know, blown out of shape. Food poisonings, minimal, because we had great food facilities on campus, well-monitored. We had a great sanitarian, Ken Reed, back in those years, and he did a marvelous job making sure that everything was sanitized, mm-hmm. if you will. So we had a good team. It worked well.
So you mentioned President Panzer and Mr. Reed. Name some other folks that came through during your time that were significant or memorable.
Well, I went through a lot of presidents, from Bob Johns through President Dennison, of course, and a lot of acting presidents in mm-hmm. between. You know, but
how about on your staff?
On my staff, great physicians, Dr. Bobowick, Dr. Paul Wagner, who just recently passed away, Dr. Jack Bruckner, Rich Paulson. These are guys that spent years and years and years with me. And the new people that are on staff now, Dr. Paulson is the senior member. Of course, he's been there. I hired him many, many years ago. And the rest of the staff are relatively new. And good young people interested in students' health. And that's what we need.
Mm-hmm. So, of course, the student health center we've been talking about is now the Curry Health Center. So you obviously have left something to the university that people find significant. I'm going to ask you to sort of brag on yourself here and tell me why it is it's named for you. What did you leave here?
I have no idea. I had a wonderful staff who worked hard. They didn't need any real direction other than pointing out the fact that we work for the students. Period. We don't work for administration, we don't work for publicity, we work for the student. And that came through loud and clear with what our staff would do. So it was a very humbling experience to have Dr. Fitch, who was my predecessor, suggest that they name the building after me. And I thought, my goodness, I'm not dead yet. I haven't contributed $1 million, which I never could earn. Because I worked for the state. At any rate, it was very humbling, believe me. It was quite nice.
I'm sure you're being modest about your influence. 30 years is a good amount of time, and I'm sure that the building is named for you for just causes.
Well, let's say this. The best leadership is by example.
Mm-hmm.
If you get out and do your work, work hard, and be as honest as you can, good things usually happen.
Well, I think we'll end on that note.
Good.
I appreciate your time. Unless there are any stories that you would like to add to the record here that I haven't touched on.
I appreciate it. My
okay.
pleasure.
Thank mm-hmm. you very much.
You bet.